Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you're listening to this from. It is nice to have you back here on the Controversial Exchange. Today, we have the fantastic Dr. Kimberly Nix Behrens. We're going to be talking about education. And really, this is kind of a two-part discussion. We talk about her new book that I'll get to shortly, but also look inward at the field of behavior analysis. We have some interesting discussions around measurement practices and how we're really fading away from the true science, natural science, that behavior analysis was founded within. Going as far as Kimberly actually talking about why she decided to actually drop her board-certified behavior analyst credential. So we're going to talk about that, but we're going to start with her book, Blind Spots. It comes out on October 20th. I'm going to read you the back of the cover here. It's available for pre-order on Amazon right now. All of us have read it already. Fantastic. This is especially useful to hand off if you're a behavior analyst to others that are outside of the field, or if you're a parent or someone that's found this because you're interested in learning and education. This is the book for you. All right, so the back of the cover. In the United States, a majority of students graduate below proficiency in all academic subjects. Parents of struggling students feel overwhelmed and confused about how to help their children simply survive school, let alone succeed. Various school reform efforts have been tried and all have failed. But all hope is not lost. A science exists that allows children to learn as individuals, even though, at school, they are educated in groups. One that avoids senseless labels that sentence children to lifetimes of failure and mediocrity. Dr. Kimberly Behrens and a team of scientists have spent the last 20 years perfecting a powerful system of instruction based on the learning, behavioral, and cognitive sciences that they call fit learning. This method of teaching has been proven to markedly improve how students understand and achieve, even for children who have been told that they have learning disabilities or other disorders that interfere with their ability to learn. Blind Spots reveals the history of our broken education system and shows that by using this teaching system in the classroom, we can unlock the vast potential hidden within every child. I hope you enjoy.
Okay, well, welcome Kimberly Behrens, Dr. Kimberly Behrens, to the Controversial Exchange. We will be discussing your book, Blind Spots, today on education and why students fail, which is so epically pertinent in our times, especially even in COVID, online education, the way that's happened, some of the shifts that have happened in the field. There's just a lot of things, I think, that are culturally and contextually relevant to what you have to say, which I hope will help inform our discussion today. Why don't I'd rather just have you just introduce yourself briefly and tell everyone. I know that you've been on other podcasts. People should know who you are. But for those that don't, who is Dr. Kimberly Behrens?
Hi. Well, you know, I'm kind of most associated with Fit Learning, which is an organization I helped, you know, establish more than 20 years ago at the University of Nevada, Reno, where I got my doctoral degree. And so Fit Learning is an organization, you know, that's grown. I mean, we started in a broom closet, literally, not kidding. And since that time, we have close to 40 locations and, you know, a lot of really awesome work going on inside of that. And we do really mainstream education work. So we're involved in, you know, academic acceleration with mainly neurotypical kids. You know, some kids come to us with a host of diagnoses, which are most of the time mythological, which we'll talk about later on this show, I'm sure. And then some actually have some real learning impairments that are actually real. But, you know, the take home point is we do a lot, you know, we're really into dealing with complex repertoires of behavior. And we really function inside the mainstream in our culture, which is, I think, pretty awesome and unfortunately a little bit rare in behavior analysis right now. So that's kind of what I'm most, I would say, associated with. And then I wrote a book, you know, that's coming out in October, really based on my 20-year career doing this, and working with kids and families. And I'd reached my breaking point, you know, enough is enough already. So it's time for, you know, for me to stop talking to just one parent at a time and one educator at a time and try to talk to more, you know, a lot more all at once about what's wrong and what their blind spots are, which is why that's what the book is called. So,
well, it's a perfect segue. Let's spring into it. I mean, you felt a compulsion, which I think is, you know, if you're a well-intentioned, well-meaning person, you're an optimist. There's this quote that I think of, Cornel West quote, is I cannot be an optimist, but I am a prisoner of hope.
Right.
And I think of that. Your book made me think of that the whole time, is that, like, you know, you see the science, you see the capacity, you see in the future, you see what the potential, And then you see all of the squandered opportunities that happened on an ongoing and continuous basis. And you articulate that so clearly.
And like, it's so easy to empathize with your anger in the book, because I mean, what behavior analyst hasn't experienced a situation like you describe right in the beginning of it, with a student who's been denied, you know, appropriate educational modifications or adaptations, or just in general curricula instruction. Yeah. So everything.
So why don't we just start with some of the stuff that's in the book? A couple of the themes, I think. I mean, do you start out as an intent as a critique of education, as a critique of learning? What is the underlying motivation other than just exposing the reality of what's going on in the educational community and the establishment of education?
Right. Well, you know, I think it's similar to what I write in the introduction, which is, you know, one of the most meaningful aspects of my career has been creating distinctions for parents and also for educators. I mean, I have had the opportunity to work and train with teachers throughout my career off and on. Not enough, you know, there's not enough of a buy-in from the educational establishment for that to have been a really big part of my career, but I have had the opportunity to talk to teachers and educators. But mainly this comes from my conversations with parents where, you know, they call me or they're in my office and they're, you know, sharing their struggles with their kid, you know, in whatever academic area it may be, and basically what they've been told about why that's happening and how, you know, the statements that have been made to them have been made from people who are seemingly experts in this. And so parents have no distinction to question it, right? There's no, you know, that's why, you know, they're blind to the fact that that's not the only interpretation of what's occurred for their kid. And so when I have the opportunity to create a distinction for a parent about what else might be possible, you know, that reading is actually a behavioral repertoire that's acquired via effective instruction. And that when kids learn to read well, then the easiest and most direct source of explanation is the fact that they haven't been instructed well. And so when I provide these kind of simple pragmatic explanations to parents, along with this is how we fix that, and it's going to take 40 hours, it's literally like a lightning bolt goes, you know, hits a parent in the face because they can't believe it. I mean, most of the time parents have been through multiple neuropsychological evaluations, have tried multiple different types of tutoring strategies or have been in special ed and nothing changes. And of course it doesn't change. I mean, we know that in behavioral science, we know why that doesn't change, but parents are at the end of their rope and they really believe that my kid's incapable of learning to read or my kid's incapable of learning to do math or my kid's incapable of ever writing, you know, being an effective writer or a communicator of ideas in written form. And, you know, and there's literally zero possibility. Like when I meet with parents, that's what kills me the most is how the way things go in the status, you know, the status quo in education is it cuts off any possibility of effective action. And so I, you know, that drives me nuts. And so that really was the catalyst for this was more than anything is just putting the information out there that might possibly have, you know, educators and teachers and stakeholders in American education pause and consider another possibility when kids fail rather than there's something neurologically wrong with them. Which is what that's the knee-jerk reaction, right? They're just, you know, whether it be they have a disability or whether it be they just aren't talented in that area, you know, like talent is the big explanatory fiction in our culture. You know, they're just not good at it. They're just not good at math. And somehow that's satisfying. That's a satisfactory explanation, which is crazy to me.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's also like so lazy.
It's so lazy.
The deepest theme, because I like to pull out themes because I don't want to just talk about everything, all the details in the books.
Well, we want people to buy the book and actually read it.
Yeah, and actually read it. So buy the book and read it. But
it's a good read.
It was actually like I was surprised and impressed for real. And I don't just say that. So my endorsement is sincere. I would tell you if I didn't like it. But I think the underlying theme that I found that I think is just something that someone needs to talk about publicly is the disconnect between ideology and a inductive pragmatic approach.
Right.
And belief as a driver or as an explanation. There's this, you know, William Baum wrote a paper on the difference between evidence and interpretation and being able to find that line.
Right. Right.
And I think that you highlight that in terms of how it relates to education particularly, but we see that trend spilling into all of the various social sciences, including our own. I mean, why don't you talk to me a little bit about that divide and kind of where you see it taking us, some of the problems, the pitfalls that you're seeing, and how that's going to potentially impact our future possibilities.
Well, I mean, especially now in the current climate we're living in politically in the United States, you know, anti-intellectualism has been a problem in our country since the beginning, you know, since we were founded. You know, because it's all been, you know, the founding of our country, all of these things have really been based on ideology. I mean, and look, I will be honest, I didn't take on politics in my book. That's one of the establishments I didn't take on. And I had, but with advice from my editors, I kind of went a different direction there, because that is I could write an entire book on that. Mm-hmm. But so I will say, you know, just the notion that belief, like belief systems, which is, you know, what I, for listeners who may be not familiar with ideology, but ideology is basically just a belief system, a system of beliefs. You know, there is an overwhelming, you know, position in America, and not just in America, around the world, but really it's shocking in America, that belief systems are as valid as scientific evidence. And it's becoming worse and worse. And so one of the fundamental problems there goes back to education, where, you know, there are a majority of Americans who actually don't know the difference and aren't trained mm-hmm. to know the difference. So they're not trained to know how to distinguish between scientific evidence and an opinion or a belief system. And so when you're blind, right, when you're blind to your belief systems as running the show, and have no, and don't even have an awareness that that's what's running you, that's when it's dangerous. I mean, if we have people, I mean, look, I'm not saying it's not dangerous for people to say, well, I know that's true, but I just choose to not believe that because I'm more comfortable believing this. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that's great either, but I'm saying that a starting point has to be that people know the difference.
Yeah. Well, you have to agree on the facts. If you can't agree on what reality is, if I see something different in the world in terms of cause and effect, and you see something different in the world in terms of cause and effect, how right. can we possibly have an articulable exchange of ideas
right.
that is in any way, shape, comprehensible to anything? So, I mean, yeah. I think that's the point that you're making there.
Shocking that we're still having these conversations, and William James wrote, you know, he was writing about this at the turn of the 20s, he was writing about this at the end of the 1800s.
Yeah.
And here we are again, still talking about how to settle metaphysical disputes. I mean,
well, you quote Sagan in the book, and that was what he pale blue dot is like, what, 77? So, I mean, like,
I know
that now is what, 50 years ago now, 40
Yikes.
Years ago.
It's,
so, yeah, we're still beating dead horses.
We're kind of, I mean,
is this indicative of a cyclical nature of these things, though? Is this the cup before the burst? I mean, is this our dip? Is this our post-reinforcement pause of the good times?
I don't know. I mean, I do think you have to have a breakdown to have a breakthrough. You know, that's, I do live inside of that every day. I mean, even with my, you know, when I'm pushing kids on academic targets and it's hard and they want to bail and they get upset and then they push through it. And it's like this unbelievable, amazing moment afterwards. Like, you know, that applies to everything in life. Like, you know, we go through breakdowns to have breakthroughs. And so I think we are going through a massive breakdown in a lot of aspects of our culture right now. And I do think from that sets the, you know, that does set, you know, occasion change rather than it, you know, us just putting everything under the surface and pretending that stuff's not there. It's all kind of, you know, now it's all festering at the surface and everyone's back out, like in all of our awful humanity is showing. I do think that does set the occasion for breakthroughs. But I do think, you know, it's also our responsibility as scientists to communicate with the public in a powerful way about what science is. I mean, Carl Sagan, you know, he devoted his career, most of his career to that. But there's not, you know, you can't really find us, you know, where's the new Carl Sagan? You know, like,
Richard
right?
Richard Dawkins is 176,000 years old. Yeah, no,
yeah.
Not a lot of them left.
Yeah, so I think that what's happened is scientists are, you know, and academics talk to themselves. and not to the public. And then what gets out to the public, you know, is pushed by people who have, you know, their public figures and their, you know, whatever their agenda might be, but in the public can't really evaluate those, you know, those statements, you know, like even things that come out like about the new, you know, learning disabilities, like, you know, there's a, the you know, citing some research on there's a correlation between, you know, this part of the brain, you know, being less activated in kids with dyslexia diagnosis versus this. And even that is scary to me because, you know, that's people not understanding the difference between correlation and causation. And people don't. I mean, and even scientists don't. I mean, people in social sciences and psychology don't understand that. They don't understand correlation and versus causation. And so that's what gets out into popular press. Like, oh, it's definitive, dyslexia exists, and it's this part of the brain that causes it. And that's not actually been demonstrated at all. There's been no cause and effect relation demonstrated at all. So I don't know. It's, you know, I think we have a responsibility as people who do our work, especially people, and that's why I wrote this book and I plan to write many more, is that I actually have an ongoing applied science kind of platform. I mean, I'm doing the work we do at Fit Learning is applied in the sense that our intention is to produce outcomes with kids in academic areas. But the way we do it is basically run like doing natural applied science with every single kid. And using those tools allows us to make a ton of discoveries. It allows us to evolve into a much better methodology. And then it allows us to have a vehicle for talking to the public because our consumers are mainstream people. So I do think there's, you know, and especially in behavior analysis in general, we have a unique opportunity to do applied science and then demonstrate its power with the public and then communicate it to the public. Whereas someone working in a laboratory on cancer research, it's not the same. You know what I'm saying? I just think that unfortunately our field is wasting that opportunity because most people aren't using the kinds of practices in their applied work that they need to be doing to actually do science as they're doing applied work, you know, combine those two.
So then let's get into that portion of it. Let's get into I think you do such a good job of clarifying where education stands in relation to us. And honestly, our target audience aren't educators. And I don't think that's punching down necessarily because they're a $6 billion industry. They have some of the most powerful unions left on the planet. They are an astounding establishment, an established body in our society and system in such a way that they are almost immune to any, not criticism, but actual systemic shift without the level of political will that it would take where someone would have to commit political suicide to make it possible. So like, I'm more concerned really about maybe the small group of people we can influence that can adapt how they're going about these things. But before we get to that part, I want to go back to the Sagan thing and like your motivation to write the book. Why don't we see enough people stepping up to the plate? I mean, you're a pretty smart person. Is it just because you've been able to create the conditions of financial independence where you're not in fear? I mean, is it a lack of courage? I mean, like, I know but I mean, like, it seems to me, because I, you know, we get a chance to communicate with a lot of people behind the scenes and we read these brilliant papers from these brilliant minds, and we still do have really smart people out there. Like, you know, people think that we don't, but there are giants still walking amongst us.
Oh my God.
But they're hidden behind this curtain and afraid to step out into the light. I mean, what is that? Why can't we get these people to open their mouths and set the record straight? Because we're walking down a very interesting path.
Well, I will say, you know, it's not easy writing in popular press. You know, I have a team of publicists now, which if you had asked me even 10 years ago, if I would be paying a team of publicists, I would be like, are you insane? But it does require that. So it requires investing in people who position you in the public eye. And it requires being willing to modify your communications so that people can hear them. which is not easy. I mean, because then you kind of feel like, oh, I'm selling out because I'm not describing the process of extinction in my book in a technical, I mean, like I write about RFT in the book, and I had, Steve was one of my advanced, my early readers. So that was a nerve-wracking experience when I was like, when Steve's like, oh, I'd love to read your book. And I'm like, oh my God, okay, great. But here's a disclaimer. Remember, the RFT chapter is for lay audience. Like I'm writing this for parents, educators, and stakeholders in American education. I'm not right. So I was so nervous sending it to him, but I mean, he loved it, which was great, but it's not, you know, you're not going to become an RFT expert by reading my book. You know, that's not the point of it. So I think it's also getting off our high horse a little bit about like how technical, like, I do see that a lot, not just in our field, in every field, like, you know, these debates over the smallest semantic things, right? You know, whether it be, you know, okay, relational frame theory versus equivalence, you know, like those kinds of debates that can go on and on and on. And you know, all those things that are very important at an intellectual level, I would say for our field, but it doesn't do us any service in communicating our powerful science to the public. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah. So the esoteric fighting versus, versus actual consumable goods that you can produce, materials.
And I also think, you know, as I mentioned in the book, it's what your goals are, you know, and I think, and look, I got this so much from my training at UNR. I mean, I have to say UNR did such a brilliant job training us in the philosophy of science. You know, we were at Stephen Pepper and we really spent a lot of time becoming sophisticated in that understanding. And so I always, you know, I think if you stand aside, what are your goals? You know, and my goals are to make a difference. You know, my goals are to change the quality of a child's life through effective instruction. And then, you know, and then a longer term goal is to transform educational practices on the planet such that they are guided by the science of human behavior. And so those are goals I have. And so like anything I do is in service of those goals. And so I would think that, you know, maybe I do think sometimes we lose sight of our goals because we get stuck in being right. You know, like being right and looking good and who's like, those kinds of things are toxic when it comes to, I think authentically, well, I think it is it's toxic for authentic communication because you're stuck inside of how you look and what, you know, and being right rather than, am I accomplishing my goal in this moment? So I don't know. I mean, I'm kind of going off on a tangent, but I do think that it is scary. I mean, I've had to invest in publicists and I had to like really work on my jargon and how I talk, how I, you know, communicate. And I do not focus on academic journals. I mean, luckily I have partners who do, like Kendra and Donnie Newsom, and you know, they're the ones who are really committed to those types of publications. And I've completely, you know, devoted the rest of my career to mainstream communications. And to be honest with you, it's difficult to do both because it's really hard, you know, all of it's hard. And so I think it's like what, you know, you choose what your goal is and then you focus on that. So I don't try to publish in, well, I would never try to publish in Java. That's another conversation, but I don't try and publish in the big behavioral journals because that's not my goal. My goal is to inform the public and the public doesn't read that. Right.
Yeah. I mean, then what? So I guess let's just ask about the science question then. I mean, right. Is it possible that, just to play devil's advocate, someone would hear what you just said and say, well, like, we do use science. You know, there's neuroscience, there's biological science, there's trauma-informed care, there's all there's all these different sciences, social sciences, you know, psychology, that are informing our perspectives. Why is your science right, Kim?
Right.
You know?
Well, and I do think it gets back to goals. Right. So, you know, when we talk about someone who wants to, you know, understand, wants to reduce behavior to neurological processes and truly understand neurologically what's going on when a person behaves in a specific way, that's a very different goal from wanting to change that behavior and produce a result with a person. So I do think, you know, again, one way to avoid being dogmatic about anything is acknowledging that people have different goals. And so I would say that there's plenty of people doing, you know, really brilliant work. And I mean, neuroscience, I got to tell you, I spend a lot of time in neuroscience. I mean, neuroscience is, I read neuroscience more than I do things in behavior analysis journals. I read, you know, neuroscience papers way more. Mm-hmm. Not because it's necessarily changing my practices, because we know in behavior analysis, we don't have to worry about that because we have a behavioral measure of what's going on neurologically because those are all connected. But I do that in the sense that that provides a unifying, that provides more almost unifying evidence about what I'm talking about. Because, you know, a lot of the really amazing work going on in neuroscience is basically what we've known all along in behavioral science, which is behavior and, you know, repeated reinforcement of behavior over time changes neurology. And we're all like, duh, like, how is that groundbreaking? But it's actually freaking groundbreaking in neuroscience. They think it's like the craziest thing ever that you can change, like you can increase white matter in kids who have dyslexia diagnoses with effective instruction. And we're like, well, what would you think was going to happen? Right. Like, so I think, again, I align myself.
Works? I'm just kidding. Phylogenetic adaptation is a result of contact with direct contingencies of the environment. That's literally the definition of Darwinian theory.
I mean, we have evolved as a species to learn from our unique environments. Like that's why, yeah. Like that's, hello, obviously, yeah. And of course, neurological processes are occurring as, you know, I always say neurological processes are behavioral processes and behavioral processes are neurological ones. Just because we want to separate these things doesn't mean they're separable, right? But I do think it's important to know what's going on in those fields because it lends credence to some of the things we've been saying in behavioral science for decades.
Yeah. But now the basic research is there to support it, though, too.
Right.
Because that's a thing. Before, it was just theoretical application and practice and, right. Like, validated through inductive results. So we had actual measures of change, but we couldn't actually explain the processes going on behind the curtain.
Yeah.
So, I mean, all this does is explain that. I think that's the conception of the – sorry, Ryan, one thing.
You're good.
The conception with the trouble of that, though, is, like, it does go back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of cause and effect and where people put their faith in terms of causation.
Yeah.
And that's the real, I think the biggest battle that anyone's going to have to sell what we have to sell and sell what you're trying to sell is getting people to change their mind over what makes how are things selected or where do they come from? Because mm-hmm. I mean, like the biggest fight that does it come from the inside or does it come from the environment? You know, it's a nature versus nurture thing. And I think, getting people to come to like the awakened, like enlightened position that they're actually end up being the same thing.
They are.
Which is basically what we just said, that distinction's artificial. Like that's a really hard conceptual leap. That's a pretty difficult thing to get through, especially if you have like all the baggage of like even you quote like religion, ideology, dogma, disciplinary
bias. Well, I mean,
bias.
Let's just be clear. All of this goes down to religion. I mean, you know, the reason belief systems are so dominant in our civilization religion is really the platform from which all of this has emerged. Is that, you know, people, you know, have those belief systems, you know, are very dominant. Belief in magic and mysticism and, you know, higher power and those things as causes. You know, that spills over into every aspect of human life, which is why, you know, disorders, you know, such as dyslexia and auditory processing disorder and, you know, all the disorders are so believable for the public because it lines up with other belief systems, right?
How many OTs do you work with?
No, I don't work with many OTs. Yeah, I mean, actually, that's not true. We have, so our director in Chicago, Aditi Mehra, she was a PhD OT and she heard one of my podcasts or something, or maybe she saw me teach my class at FIP. I don't remember. But she was like, she's amazing because she literally like, was like measurement behavior. This is how do I have a PhD in OT and I've never gotten this, right? But not many. I haven't worked with a ton of OTs.
So what's your take on this multidisciplinary collaborative approach that seems to be the dominating, ideological push under the guise of ethical obligation being basically scripted into the narrative of our literature, which is what's happening. Guys.
Yeah. Well, I as I write in the book, one thing, if there's anything I can get that I would as like a goal of my life inside of distinctions is for people to really do some critical analysis of what an explanation is, right?
Love that.
Because, and this is dominant in every establishment. I mean, when you talk about the psychological establishment, well, mainly the psychological and the medical establishments, but it's everywhere in pop culture, you know, where we think naming things is sufficient, is a sufficient explanation. And that's a very, very tough thing for people to grasp, because that does take a level of critical thinking and some training around that understanding. But you know, if people could understand that, you know, that, you know, when you're looking at explanation, when you're talking about an explanation, you know, what, where is your evidence of that? And if your evidence only lies in a name or a classification, well, that's just a name and a classification. And that's not any, there's no evidence there. You know, if your evidence, you know, how do you know a child, you know, this, how you know Johnny's dyslexic? Well, he didn't perform well on this reading assessment, or he doesn't read well. And so, okay, so why doesn't he read well? Well, he's dyslexic, right? And so like when you end up like one, that's always what I train my parents. And like, if you find yourself in a circular logic loop, right? Like in a circular reasoning loop, then you most likely are stuck with an explanatory fiction, because explanatory fictions produce loops that you can't get out of, right? And so I think if anything, you know, with this book and the other books I plan to write, it's getting people to understand when they're stuck in an explanatory fiction, like when they're dealing in an explanatory fiction that they're stuck in a loop around, because the explanation isn't real. The explanation is just a label or a name or something they've classified, rather than like being able to, you know, if it's a true explanation, then you should be able to go underneath it and go underneath it again and go underneath it again and go underneath it again. If you know what I'm saying, I mean, that's kind of a metaphor saying going underneath it, but you know, why is Johnny such a poor reader? Well, he, you know, as he was reading, he tended to reverse the, you know, he was reading from right to left instead of left to right and mixed up some stem letters. Well, why does he do that? Well, his stem letter discrimination, you know, he's only doing that at about 20 per minute, you know, 20 per minute with like 10 per minute errors. Well, why does he do that? Well, when you look at his basic rapid automatic naming skills, he tends to, you know, really have a hard time with just finite visual discrimination speed. Well, and so like, so again, like if you're not stuck in an explanatory fiction, you can take it down. Like you can, you know, you can look at like, okay, well, here's one level of evidence and here's another level of evidence like that I'm getting at it. This is a behavioral repertoire. Like here's some skills. And here's another thing. Well, let me mess around with one of these things I mentioned, you know, let me just try to move his rate of responding on stem letter discrimination and decrease his errors. And then let's see how that shows up when he's reading his passage again. And if I've moved it around and made it better, well, then we can suggest that was a skills deficit because we fixed it. Right. So I think, you know, pragmatism, right, is a really great thing to know how to do, because then you don't get stuck in those never-ending loops, those never-ending circular loops of, you know, where there's no answer, there's no solution, there's no possibility. Like if you leave a meeting and there's no possibility, then there's an explanatory fiction hanging around in there somewhere. Otherwise, there'd be effective action that could be taken. So I always say, you know, if you're in an IEP meeting and you walk out of that meeting and there's not a single effective action has been identified, then that entire meeting was just under a cloud of explanatory fictions, right? And you're stuck. So, you know, it's almost like if you can take effective action with respect to something and then measure it and then with using the, you know, the scientific method, evaluate if whether or not it changed, then you can be pretty confident you're not stuck in an explanatory fiction. You know, you can be pretty confident that you're not stuck in that, you know, in that nominal fallacy or thinking that you've explained something just because you named it. Which is, to be quite honest, that is the number one problem. That's the number one problem. And it's not just in education. Think about it everywhere. We do it all the time as humans, right? You know, why is she late for work? Oh, she's just kind of lazy. She doesn't have a great work ethic. You know, why, right? Like, why is she, we do it all the time. It's constant in our culture that we just name stuff and, oh yeah, that makes sense. What if we've just named her something? We've said she doesn't have a work ethic. What does that mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, it creates a framework of fixed mindset. It creates this like, and also it leads to reification. Yes. I mean, if you start treating ideas as things, then anything is real. And then if anything is real, nothing is real. And you can't actually have a conversation about what's happening around you.
Right.
I mean, it's just like, it's this bizarre, absurd, like, it's this bizarre absurdity that if everyone's right, everyone can be right. And there's ways for us to work these things out. And at some point in time, I feel like there has to be a line in the sand as part of this conversation to say, everyone is entitled to an opinion. Everyone's entitled to a point of view. Everyone brings their history, whether or not they want to or not, because that's how it works. Life works.
Yeah.
But there is a reality. There is a particular best way to go about doing things relative to the type of evidence we have. There are basic facts that we have been able to uncover in terms of learning, in terms of performance, in terms of whatever, pick your poison in terms of topic, that are irrelevant and immune to whatever type of belief or interpretation you choose to apply to the thing. So I really appreciate the fact that someone who's a grown-up is out there saying it. So thank you.
I was going to ask her.
Thank God. Amen.
I was going to ask. So like, I think a big part of this that you've talked about and what I've always believed in is that you need educational material out there for people to start to consume and understand this. Could be something like the book that you're putting out, or it could be different things that are embedded in within our training programs. Like, have you thought about the different ways that maybe we could start to include like training around this, right? On right. How to frame things like early behavioral or early education, right?
Well, I think what you're, I don't mean to interrupt you, Ryan, but I think what you're really saying is it's like, how do we circumvent this fad of the year, fad of the month mindset that is completely attached
and do it
to education
in a way that's accepted, that doesn't look like from the other party that it's an ideological push, right? That it's actually like there's a value to this pragmatic view, right?
So do you mean education in terms of the public, or do you mean like education in terms of kids?
You'd probably, I mean, I don't know, like it could be either. Like, how do we start kind of I don't think it's going to be one area. Like
educational establishment.
Yeah, how do you start tackling this, you know?
Right. Well, and that's, look, I got to tell you, I obviously didn't go in the front door of schools. I tried way back when. When I was running my dissertation, I ran it in Washoe County School District, which is the biggest school district in Nevada. And I really tried to go in the front door. The outcomes with my disc, which was a huge teacher training study, were unbelievable. And the teachers were, the social validity measures were, they were happy with their jobs finally and feeling effective. And it was all great. And then, of course, the minute the administration was over, they went back to their old ways. And so I haven't gone in the front door of schools because I just know how difficult that is to do, because again, you're dealing with an ideological institution, just like our politics, you know, like that's an ideological institution, and it's similar to religion. I mean, it's very difficult to change people's minds about their religious beliefs. You know, it's no amount of evidence is going to change their minds. And unfortunately we've gotten into that situation in politics and in education in our country. And so as I put forth in the book, I think that the only option is for as citizens is for us to determine, you know, in matters of human life where being effective is really important, you know, like where it really matters, like outcome matters, effectiveness matters. Because look, you know, what is the one area of our culture that has dramatically evolved since like the Middle Ages? It's medicine. I mean, you know, back in the Middle Ages, medicine and religion were still intertwined. And so it was highly belief-based. You know, we believe that these humors in the human body are causing ailments and we have to balance them and by bloodletting and all the disgusting things that they did. And most of their patients died, but it didn't matter because what they did matched their belief systems. And that was the litmus test, right? So the litmus test in ideological institutions isn't about outcome or effectiveness. It's about coherence. So it's about whether beliefs and then the practices occurring match up with beliefs. So really, if you talk about like Stephen Pepper, like the truth criterion in ideological institutions is coherence. It's like, is what's happening aligned with what we believe should be happening? And there's no evaluation of outcomes, right? So that's the case in politics. That's the case in religion. It always has been. And that's the case in education, sadly. So there comes a time where we have to ask ourselves, you know, what would have happened if our medical institutions hadn't evolved past that, right? well, we wouldn't have an overpopulation problem. And this would definitely not be our first global pandemic in 100 years. You know, we'd be dealing with this all the time. So because we as a culture decided, and I don't know if we did it covertly or overtly, but we all decided this, we draw a line in the sand when it comes to human life. And like, we want medicine to be about science and evidence and effectiveness. And we're drawing the line on that. And it happened. And now our medical institutions are, now I'm not saying healthcare mm-hmm. as a system is effective, but I'm saying
the science of
medicine,
of creating health. Yes.
I mean, yeah. Our life expectancy has been transformed. It's obvious. It's just obvious. So I think the only, instead, you know, getting into ideological debates is futile. You know, the only answer is, what are our goals for this institution? And if our goals for this institution, like for instance, for education, if the goal is and should be the effective education of future generations, you know, outcomes being produced with kids that are measurable, then that should serve as the guide for what is effective, meaning it's evidence-based. It's about, you know, did this produce an outcome or did it not? And if it didn't, we need to evolve and do something different. Rather than ideologically, are what teachers doing, do what teachers do match what we believe they should be doing? Which is what is that's the criterion in education. The litmus test is, are teachers teaching in a way that we believe is correct? Rather than, are teachers teaching in a way that produce effective outcomes with kids? Those are two very different things. And so if I can move the culture or help move the culture into a way that's what actually the citizenry is demanding. Like the citizenry is demanding, actually, kids should be educated with respect to outcomes and effectiveness. Then that naturally makes it move in a pragmatic direction, because you can't do that without science.
So right? Is the way to push culture, like, do you think most likely just through educating them in ways like this book, or is there other strategies that you think you can push on that culture with as well?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think writing more popular, like I write a lot of op-eds and a lot of, you know, Thrive Global, you know, those kind of places. I write books, speaking to the different audiences, right? Like not just speaking to behavioral audiences, but speaking to different audiences. So, you know, being on different types of podcasts, being on different types of webinars. Like I just did a big one in New York for, you know, it was mainly for, you know, parents and educators. You know, it's basically communicating in that way. And then I definitely think it's the way it's communicated, because, you know, in the early part of my career, and even the first draft of this book, I'm not going to lie, you know, my self-righteous indignation was like on the forefront of everything. And that immediately turns people off. So I also think it's the way it's communicated. And so, you know, what I try to communicate is like what my goals are, you know, like what I want, you know, I'm not kidding when I say in the book that, you know, it's the millions of kids who don't have the opportunity to receive, instruction guided by behavioral science. That actually does make me lose sleep at night. I am not kidding. Like, you know, I delved into some really unfortunate, like scary stuff doing the research for my book, you know, things that I knew were bad, but I didn't know were so bad. Like, you know, a school district in Eastern St. Louis that the kids on a regular basis can't go to school because there's raw sewage running through the lunchroom on a regular basis. And they can't play in the playground because there's lead contaminated soil from the factories behind the school. And I mean, the income disparity, you know, not only is education ineffective across the board, as I said in my book, and the data support that statement, but the problem is with low-income kids, not only are they having effective instructional practices being used, they're also having to attend horribly, underfunded schools that are dangerous and dirty and unpleasant places to be. So, you know, when I speak, it's really from the passion of like, I care about those kids, and I care about income inequality in the United States, and I care about, you know, human rights. I care that education actually isn't a privilege, and neither is healthcare. Like, I think that people have a right to healthcare and people have a right to an effective education. And I think we all do better when that happens. Mm-hmm. When you come at it from that place, rather than I'm right and I'm here to tell you about how right I am with my practices, when I come at it from like, you know, we all do better with an educated public, And we should all be committed to an educated public. And we should look at our track record in our educational system for the last century and realize that we are not producing an educated public. We're actually producing an unbelievably illiterate public. It's astounding. I mean, especially kids of color. So like, you know, close to 90% of children of color are below proficiency in all academic subjects. That is a crime against humanity. I mean, that is a democratic, the shame of our democracy. It's like, and no one talks about that. No one talks about that. And when they do, they attribute it to macro level issues, which are true. I mean, sure, funding of schools matters. Teachers, having enough teachers matters, having enough school supplies matters. But no one's talking about the fact that the practices themselves don't work. And produce, and most of the time they're using aversive control, which then produces environments that kids want to either fight or flee. So it's all awful. And so when you come at it from a place of like humanitarian values, and like, if you want to make a difference, if you want to level the playing field, if you want to, you know, shrink the income, you know, the income inequality gap in the United States, then pragmatism is our answer. I don't know. Yeah, who knows? That's my strategy, at least.
Yeah.
I got to share, just to be selfish here. I decided to kind of do a pivot, and I'm trying my hand in the public school thing this year for the first time. And I have to say, like, it's like weird how, there is some serendipity, I think, sometimes with certain things. Because I think everything you had to say is matching up. Everything that I read matched up exactly with where my head's been. I've been literally furiously writing training after training, thought after thought, idea after idea that needs to be addressed that is covered in this book because of things I'm seeing firsthand. It's only been a few months, and I'm already thinking to myself, maybe education's, and I'm going to, this is our podcast. So is it so fucked that it's just time to move on? I mean, like, do we do the fit learning route where it's like, you know what? I'm going to approach it from a completely separate angle. I'm going to build a completely autonomous system that's not reliant on all the various structures and all the various funding sources and the way that they're set up, that isn't beholden to the particular special interests and governing entities that want to exert control over the content, the material, and the process. And just say, you know what, this is too broken to fix. Let's reset the board. And maybe if this gets good enough, you guys can come and do this at some point. But I can't, because at some point when you're holding the ocean back with your arms, eventually the waves will eat you. I mean, it's inevitable.
And well, that's why I started FIT and didn't, try to infiltrate schools. You know, I went into private industry, and what that's allowed us to do is do the applied science the way we wanted to do it, and in the way that was necessary to evolve a replicable model of instruction, and then rapidly expand. I mean, now we're getting, you know, our outcome analyses every quarter, we have an N size of, you know, 2,000 kids. And so when you're moving 2,000 kids, almost a percentile rank per hour of instruction, which is literally unheard of on the planet, when you do that for long enough, and when you have a large enough N, that's when people have to start kind of paying attention. And then what you do is, I mean, my hope is that, you know, eventually with enough, you know, you start in the inner city, you start in with the poor kids that are, you know, you start where they're desperate, right? And you, because they are. And then you find funding. If you can't get government money, you find philanthropists who want, you know, you have a track record, you know, like that's what we're doing at FIT. So, you know, we're developing a model that is replicable in schools, and I'm doing my due diligence to make this a public facing company where there's, you know, there's books and op-eds and news interviews and things of that sort. So there's, the visibility. I don't know why I had such a hard time with that word. And then if you can't find a government agency that wants to support this, there are philanthropists who do. And then you develop model schools in really crappy areas. I mean, that's what I'll tell you. Like, you know, and I'm in New York, and, you know, I've got Bloomberg here, which is great. So I'm doing everything I can to get a meeting with that dude, because I got to tell you, do I, you know, am I, regardless of what your politics are, Bloomberg has a ton of money and he cares about education. He tried to do stuff in New York. Again, he wasn't informed by our science. He you know, but he does care about education. So, I mean, Bill Gates and all these huge people who have all this money, who's in their ear? The people who do the same thing, mm-hmm. rather than we are the ones who should be in their ear. So, but we can't be in their ear if we're just in our little bubble in behavior analysis, right? They're not going to pay attention to us. They're not going to recognize us. And so that's kind of my, I agree with you. I think that, you know, going after this, is multifaceted and it's a marathon. I mean, like the first 20 years of this marathon for me have been developing the model. And evaluating and testing it to see if it's replicable. That's been the first 20 years. And now I wrote the book because now I'm ready. It is replicable and it's unbelievable. And we produce those outcomes. I don't care if it's if it's Mandy, my director in Perth, Australia, or if it's Judy in British Columbia, I don't care. The outcomes are the same. It works. And not only is it replicable at the learner level, it's replicable at the training level for people we train to do this. So the first 20 years was develop the model. And now my entire focus is disseminate the model. And it's disseminate the model to, you know, anyone who is a stakeholder. And then hopefully there will be a stakeholder who has a ton of money and wants to invest in a pilot project in a really poor performing school. And then we demonstrate those outcomes because we do it like scientists. And then we replicate that. And then we replicate that. And then we replicate that until eventually, you know, and not only do we replicate it, we demonstrate a lot of other reinforcers for the educational establishment, like saving money.
So
one
of the most recent episodes we did was with Michael Maloney. It's actually the most recent.
Oh yeah, I love him. I love Michael Maloney.
Same, agreed. What we ended up talking about there a little bit was written in your book as well about Project Follow Through.
Yeah.
So the hard question, maybe you can speak around, is so if you get to that point, like, have you thought about how to try to avoid what happened in there? Like, is there ways to kind of counter that?
Well, the problem with Project Follow Through was that it was a government study, right? It was a federally funded government study. And unfortunately, the majority of the participants were not behavioral. You know, there were two models in the entire 25 or whatever were included that were from our, you know, from our kind of orientation. The rest were from the progressive education model. And they have definitely had more power and influence. And so, you know, and again, because it was an ideological institution, the data didn't matter. It was about, it was like throw money at the failing methods that match our belief systems.
Yeah.
So I do think that, you know, it being a government, I mean, unless we have some unbelievably amazing new next president, knock on wood, that, you know, embraces science and embraces this stuff and wants to put some amazing task force in place. Mm-hmm. That would be super cool. But so I think with the Project Follow-Through, which who knows if that's ever going to happen, but if the Project Follow-Through study is any indication of, I mean, that is almost like the only evidence you need about it being an ideological institution.
Yeah.
Because the outcomes did not matter whatsoever. You know,
So that's where, like, if you can get to the position where you had a school district to start working within, like, do you think you can counter that since you're the private organization coming in?
I think that, you know, one of the problems with Project Follow Through, it was pitting methods against each other. Do you know what I mean?
Rather than, so like these are outcomes and goals that we're trying to achieve and how do we do that?
And turn it into model survivor rather than actually looking for like evidence of efficacy. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So it was like this competition among methods rather than it being this school is in crisis and we have, you know, we've got a philanthropist who's going to give us $1 million to go in and transform this entire district. Mm-hmm. And we're going to use behavioral science to do that. And we're going to replicate the fit learning model of instruction. We're going to use precision teaching and direct instruction and, we're going to train teachers to do this stuff. And then we're going to take their baseline test scores. And then that's our rubric. Mm-hmm. And we're going to compare their test scores from the previous year against their test scores after the model. So rather than it be, let's check this model and this model, let's compare all these different models and see which one's better. It's, let's take a failing school as a baseline and then see, can we move those scores and how dramatically we can move them by using behavioral science to do that, rather than, you know, this whole hodgepodge of approaches, seeing which outcomes are better. You know what I mean?
What do you think about the clinical side of the field? Because I mean, like, honestly, if you come from UNR, obviously you have a heavy contextual background, obviously. Yes. And you have not a heavy PT background. You are a PT person. You're a precision teacher by, you know, training and
very much so.
Positioning. I mean, and that's almost an outsider looking into like an applied realm of behavior analysis also. So you're kind of like a stranger in a strange land, almost at both sides of the fence here. So, I mean, what is your perspective looking in at the way clinical, quote unquote, behavior analysis, not as a field, but as like that applied mental health side, has kind of evolved and has developed and what it looks like now relative to what you're saying? Because I honestly think your critique is enough to get way, can get, it can look outward to education, but it can look inward as well. That's why I ask.
Sadly. I said this on my last podcast with Matt Sikoria, but I mentioned that I'm no longer a board certified behavior analyst.
I missed that.
Yes. So that was a big one for me. Cause I'll be honest with you. I got my first certification in Florida when it was just a thing. It was a new thing. So I've for all intents and purposes been a board certified behavior analyst since like 1995.
Wow.
So, you know, it'd been a long time. So I didn't renew my credential, for various reasons. So I definitely don't feel like I'm an applied behavior analyst. I mean, I do not feel, like I do ABA. I would never say I do ABA, which I don't.
Yeah. No one would say that they do that.
I don't do ABA. So my biggest statement is going to be that the fact that our field, our applied branch, has strayed so far from our roots as a natural science is a tragedy. The fact that our field is using measurement practices that align with education and not with the science of behavior makes no sense to me, and is one of the biggest reasons our field has made very little progress in other areas of human life outside of autism. And the fact that even those services aren't going that well. I mean, I live in New York, and I'll be honest with you, I am hard pressed to find an effective behavior analyst in the state of New York. I am not, who is doing autism intervention with kids. Percent correct is not a measure of behavior. It never has been, it never will be. And it did not come from our field. It comes from education. So I wrote an entire book on how flawed education is, and that we have a century of evidence of education being unbelievably ineffective. Yet those same practices are now dominating our applied branch. It is shocking. It's shocking that people don't understand that rate of response is the fundamental measure of behavior, and that acceleration is our only measure of learning that is quantifiable that we have in our field. I mean, in any field. I mean, acceleration is the only quantifiable measure of learning that exists. The change in rate over time is the only way we have to quantify learning in that way, in a standard way. And no one uses it. I mean, we do, obviously, but very few people use it. And so I don't understand how you can talk about learning when you're not measuring learning. And I don't understand how you think you can analyze behavior when you're not measuring behavior. Those make no sense to me. So, you know, most behavior analysts do not measure behavior, and they do not measure learning. Percent correct and then looking at a trend on a stretch to fill graph is not measuring behavior and analyzing learning over time. It's just not what it is. So the measure of practices in our field are tragic, or it's a travesty.
So I think the reason I ask that question is because I feel like we can't get our own house in order. How can we possibly expect to influence others? I mean, that's just the bottom line. If you don't clean your room, like who are you going to tell everybody else to get it together? So like that concerns me, not with what you have to say, but with the fact that one person is one person, and it usually takes a chorus of voices to actually make enough noise that aren't necessarily worthy of people's attention. Because, I mean, if we're going to talk about the modern world, this is an attention game. You're talking about having publishers. So, I mean, like, that's what their job is, to facilitate the ability for you to gain eyeballs. I mean, that's what we do here at the podcast. And if you're, I just feel like if you can't necessarily garner the kind of attention that would be connected to the type of results that you're talking about or reporting, but rather within this paradigm that has seemed to completely sucked the life and the actual efficacy of what we do, the spirit of it, it leaves me with this, I want to go full tilt nihilistic perspective, but it makes me super sad, man. And it zaps my hope towards
it made Ogden Lindsley really sad.
Yeah.
And you know, Ogden Lindsley, the way the field diverged, when, you know, he really was the first person to take the behavioral science out of the laboratory and do it in an applied setting, as, you know, as a student of Skinner's. And when he saw the divergence of the field happening, that was a tragedy for him. And he lived with that for the rest of his career. And I mean, that's why everyone always thought Og was angry and cranky. Well, of course Og was angry and cranky, because he couldn't believe it. Like, he couldn't believe what happened after we left the basic lab, that all of that just went out the window. That, you know, the idea of a cumulative record so that we could look at standard slopes was somehow foreign now. And the fact that rate of response was the basic measure of behavior was somehow thrown out the window. And that time somehow didn't matter anymore in the analysis of behavior. And that we shouldn't act like scientists in the applied setting, just like we would in the basic setting. Like, he couldn't believe any of those things were happening. And when they happened, and it's clear, you know, that's what's occurred, which is why I don't consider myself a behavior analyst. I don't say behavior analysis once in my book. I don't know if you noticed that.
I noticed that you refer to it as behavior science. There was a general scolding of the use of that term recently that both raised my temperature. And I know that Ryan and I both had a conversation yeah. about it. So go ahead.
I was going to say I think it's pretty clear after reading and watching you for a number of years of, and this has really been part of our culture's always been somewhat fractured. It seems like since this was talked about in the 60s and 70s of like, we have a professional certification route, but we have this, they might call themselves different names, behavioral scientists or nonlinear contingency analysts or things like that. But we have this sect of very brilliant people, like unbelievably brilliant, that don't opt into that, or things change and they don't really pop into that mainstream ABA world. And it's because it's not right. It's like, it's missing the core components, right? Of like true science. So,
Is it a fluency problem though? Is it a culture problem? Is it a
training problem?
Is it a money problem?
No, I think it's training. I think it's a training problem. It's like none of the training programs are training this. So no BCBAs are getting. I mean, I cannot tell you how many BCBAs, actual BCBAs that I've met, that have no idea that frequency and rate are the same. They have no idea that you cannot understand count without time, and that is an absolutely ludicrous measure that no science uses, no science uses counts without time, period. That doesn't exist as a measure. And BCBAs do not know that. That rate is a measure of response probability. When I cannot tell me what, like, do not, have never heard that. So it's shocking. The training is shocking.
Even more basic, like, they don't know how to break complex skills down into component skills. When I was reading that part of your book, I was thinking many of them are so overwhelmed with clients, they just use assessments. And if the assessments aren't giving them what they need, they don't know where to go from there.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Oh man. The model framework of a component or tool component composite analysis in and of itself, I mean, rate is critical, don't get me wrong, but I mean, just that as a conceptual framework for approaching problem solving in and of itself, would have an exponential effect on outcomes, just because at least they'd be targeting the right skill.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing, is if you can't identify the problem accurately, how can you possibly...
Well, you get into that circle again. Why aren't they doing this? Because the assessment says they're not doing this. Well, how do we fix that? Well, I don't know. I'll look to the assessment. And like, you get into that same sort of
thing.
Well,
the motivation's wrong, dude. Get the right... You don't have the right reinforcer. Keep out reinforcing problems rather than looking at how to appropriately troubleshoot them. So yeah, that's wow.
And that's what's so infuriating for me is, like, then I hear about all these, and look, I'm not in the autism world. Like, I'm not in that whole EIDI autism world anymore. And I haven't been for a long time, but I will say, you know, I hear people talk about some of these new, like, standards of practice, like, you know, the errorless instruction and then the mass first, I mean, maybe I'm even behind the time. So like mass versus distributed trialing and the 3-second prompt delay procedures and all these crazy things. I'm like, all of these ridiculous procedures have been developed because the measurement system is flawed. Like, you can't see anything. And also, you're not giving your kids enough opportunities to actually respond and have that response reinforced. I mean, if you're running a 5-trial block, that is nothing. You know, versus when everything we do is timed. So like, you know, even if I'm running a trial block with a kid, right? Like, even if, like, everything we do in FIT is timed. So like, even direct instruction interactions, right? So like, when we're teaching concepts. So like, when I do concept learning at FIT, it's timed. But that, you know, for a behavior analyst to look at that, it would seem like a discrete trial block, right? Because I'm asking questions and then the learner's responding with an answer. And so we time that. And we count their corrects and their errors and their prompts, and we chart it. We put it on a standard acceleration chart. So even in that situation, when I'm looking, you know, I get kids responding in like a discrete trial block 30 times a minute. 30 times a minute versus what, 5 to 10 trials an hour? So when you have a kid who's not, when you're not reinforcing and shaping and building and strengthening behavior enough, well, of course, you're going to have a ton of errors, and learning's not going to happen because it's not being reinforced. I mean, they're not behaving and having that response reinforced enough. So then all these mythical procedures have to be invented to deal with kids with autism's over selectivity and kids with autism's lack of generalization. And, you know, all of a sudden it becomes about the organism rather than it's about your teaching procedures. Like, you're not producing an opportunity for the learner to behave and have that behavior reinforced enough.
Yeah.
So you have to come up with weird, very decontextualized and arbitrary prompting hierarchies to deal with the fact that you wouldn't need to do that if you were just reinforcing the crap out of that behavior because you're making sure the learner's engaging in it a ton, right?
I think part of that is also, though, a response to the model in terms of service delivery, too, where people are put in this position to have really unsophisticated people delivering the instruction with very limited training opportunities. So they've taken all these things from Lovaas and on that were used as modifications to be able to transfer that technology, and they've evolved into dogmas of principle which don't make any sense, and they don't know the history or how they came about, so they think those are actual rules rather than them just being some way somebody did it for one thing one time because that's what was necessary,
which is so far away from the actual philosophy that they were built upon. It is unbelievable.
So it's like it's this broken system across the board. So I mean, like,
I feel
between
like
education
it's...
and behavior analysis, though, man, it's like this weird battle of like false. It's a false sense of self-righteousness on both sides of the court, in my opinion, because they're both wrong. And you know, when what Kimberly's talking about here is she's talking about shifting things to that inductive pragmatic approach and going back to rate of response and incorporating the notion of behavior science back into it, but. I mean, it becomes this weird, it's going to be a long game to the extreme because honestly, it's a chicken or the egg problem. If our educational system is so broken,
right,
so as to produce learners that can't, which is kind of what we're talking about, and that we have these sophisticated technologies that require practitioners that can, then how do we fill in that gap to fix that broken cycle, right? Because that's where we really are at this point.
Or do you just build a new cycle?
Yeah, I mean that, but I mean, I think that, which is, we've already asked that, but I mean, like, we have to some point find that solution. So, I mean, I think that's what you're getting at here. So educating parents matters. And I spent what's funny is that my nephew is 9 or 8 years old. He turns 9 in a couple of days. So he's in the third grade, and he was He's in the third grade. He was reading at a fifth grade level 8 months ago before COVID hit. He is now barely on grade level.
Yeah.
And he's failing all his classes through the online thing that they have.
Yeah.
So is he failing them or is this system totally whacked out? Because how do you lose two grades worth of reading level in such a short period of time? He didn't get stupider. He didn't get hit on the head. Like, he didn't all of a sudden develop some bizarre brain trauma that made him impossible to learn. So, like, what are we talking about here?
Well, I mean, you know, look, you lose it. You don't use it, you lose it. So, you know, with the whole COVID thing, with kids being at home and parents being overwhelmed, and there's a lot more screen time, a lot less reading, you know, who knows, right? Like, he's probably just not been behaving with respect to reading material very, very much, and having that behavior reinforced. But I'll tell you, there's a skills massively decline when they're not used. I mean, even when we build kids' rates to like 100 per minute on, you know, decoding words, or 60 per minute on math facts, if a kid goes, I always tell parents this, I'm like, look, this isn't magic. It was like, you know, your kid's now doing 60 math facts a minute and can apply them like crazy and complicated math skills. But if your kid goes to a donkey school where he's not required to use his math facts for anything for a long time, and he's given a calculator, those aren't going to, you know, I can't promise you those are permanent, because he's got to keep practicing his math facts. He's got to, by using them. So even fluent skills can decline when they're not used. Now, all the retention and out, you know, we've done a lot of retention studies, and we've found that those kinds of previously fluent skills, we call it, oh my God, why can't I, I'm blanking on this word, recovery. So the recovery of fluency for a previously retained skill is much faster than establishing fluency from the beginning, from nothing. So we do get recovery of previously established skills much more quickly. But, you know, if I have kids who've been at FIT for a couple of years and they're crushing life, and then they go to some donkey progressive school where they're like cooking and playing with dolls in the corner and like playing it with, you know, drawing letters in the sand, they're going to lose those skills if they don't keep practicing. And that's happened to me multiple times, where I've had kids, parents put them in a Montessori program or something, and then they come back a year later and they're like, my kid can't read anymore. And I'm like, well, you know, they could, and I promise you we'll get it back really fast. But if he hasn't practiced reading in a year, like,
yeah,
you know, well, he's going to lose it. So we all do that, right? I mean, even like when I write, I mean, when I'm on a writing roll, like with my book, and when I'm writing a lot of op-eds, I mean, I can just, I'm just blasting stuff out, blasting it out. Mm-hmm. I took like a few, my father was sick over the summer, and I went through a hard time, and I took about 6 weeks off where I didn't write anything. And on that first day back when I had to write an op-ed, I was like, oh my God. Like I just that, like trying to evoke the stimulus conditions of writing again. And like, I read a bunch of my other op-eds, and but it was so clunky, you know, just that little hiatus, you know, we all see it. So behavioral repertoires will get kind of rusty if they're not used, which is probably what happened with your nephew.
I think the real question then is, so is it state Congress first, or is it Senate, or what are you running for? I'm not sure.
I'm just curious. Oh God, I don't know about politics. Well, first of all, I have some skeletons in my closet. I'm kind of kidding. I don't want people all digging around in my. I don't love that stuff. Like, you know, when they go in your background.
I don't know if anyone does nowadays.
I went to Rollins College. I don't know if you guys know where that is.
I don't know what that is, but it sounds fine.
Orlando. Rollins,
we like to have fun at
Rollins. Oh, I see. You're in Florida. So, yeah.
It's kind
literally
of...
all the worst things ever happen in Florida. All you have to do is Google Florida man and your birthday, and something horrifying happened for sure.
I have a dream, and I'm not going to lie. The other night, I had a dream that I did get appointed Secretary of Education by Kamala Harris, who was the president. And I was woke up, and I'm like, what an amazing dream. And I was like, that's a nightmare, actually. And then I started thinking about it. I was like, maybe it's not a nightmare. So I don't know. I might consider politics. And
I mean, unless you start taking hostages, that would be the most frustrating job on the planet.
I know. But I will say, you know, one of the biggest issues also in education is the lack of a standard method. And actually, that's blasphemy in education. Like, you're never supposed to talk about method. You're never supposed to talk about, they don't even have a, you know, they don't even have a national curriculum. And I don't know if you guys have been up on politics, but sometimes it's on the ballot. So sometimes a national curriculum and national standards will show up on the ballot, and it's, you know, overwhelmingly voted against because people think that infringes on their rights and that, you know, it's big government and it should be local control. But I you know, what I want people to think about with respect to that is like, what if each city had different standards for best practice in medicine? Like, would you want to go, would you, like, just because you live in like in New Jersey, you're not eligible for a specific cancer treatment because that's just not how they do things there, and that you have to move to a different city to get the effective treatment for cancer? Like, so to be quite honest, education should actually be depoliticized, and because it's not, and it shouldn't be political. It should be about effectiveness, and that should come from science. And so there should be, you know, it should be like, you know, panels of behavioral scientists putting forth recommendations around what our national standards in education should be. And actually, the notion that there is no one method is just simple lack of understanding. Yeah. That actually the learning process is systematic. Everyone, you know, the learning process is the same, regardless of your age, your socioeconomic status, your gender, your race. Humans learn through repeated reinforced, you know, practice of their behavior, period. I mean, hello, that's how we learn. So, I mean, the learning process should dictate how instruction occurs. And that should be a national standard. And that national standard should be guided by scientists. Rather than every single district, they have their own curriculum, they have their own objectives, they have their own standards. I mean, I moved from Reno to New York, and I had my daughter in the district, you know, like it was crazy. Like, it was as if I'd gone to another country with respect to how different it was in New York than it was. That's absurd. That's why, I mean, to be quite honest, that's why COVID has been a disaster. Because there's not been a national science-based response to a disease. It shouldn't be a political, so same thing, education should be depoliticized. It should be about, we should all agree that kids should be effectively educated, and then we should embrace pragmatic values and scientific practices in achieving that goal.
How do we deal with the polarization though? Because I mean, like, that's really what you're talking about, because I agree with you. COVID is, just from an educational perspective, mm-hmm. It's not even every district has its own policy. Every school has been basically permitted to have their own way, own opening criteria. It's so absurd that you can't even wrap your mind around it. It's literally chaos creation inherently for no reason other than the fact that there's no even semblance of political courage in the slightest to say, no, there's a right way to do this. This is how we're all agreeing to do it. Even if they did it from a state perspective, at least it was like large enough regions where the impact mattered. But like it's astonishing.
It is astonishing.
But going back to what you have to say about that, what, I mean, all of that is rooted in the reality that we live in such a polarized culture. I mean, what, how do we survive that? Because there's not a lot of room for heterodox opinion today. And you are pretty, in my opinion, innocuous heterodox opinion in terms of like, what you're saying should not be controversial in the slightest.
It's going to be. It's a simple fact. It will be. I think it will be greeted with as controversial by a lot of people.
I'm sure it
shouldn't be.
I know, but it's. I mean, their objections are preposterous. And they're also ideological. They're also definitely self-interested. In no way, shape, or form could they produce any substantive evidence to the contrary. So I mean, that's. Like, how do you survive? How can you be a contrarian? How can you have that heterodox opinion? How can you speak that controversial counter, you know, whatever perspective without getting to the point where either super politicized one way or the other? I mean, that's right. How do you plan to survive it? Are you just going to soldier on and be happy the fact that you have built infrastructure that you can support yourself? Because not everyone has that luxury.
So I will say that I didn't write the book to make friends. And I knew I wouldn't. You know, I knew that I was writing about some things that would strike a nerve with certain groups of people. And so, you know, I always say, if you're not pushing, you know, if you're not creating some upset, then you're not, you know, I'm not doing my job.
You're not disrupting beliefs.
You're not disrupting beliefs. Like you, yeah. It's, I mean, ignorance is bliss, right? Like remaining blind to things. you know, it is probably more comfortable for a lot of people, but that's not how change happens. So I'm actually okay with it. And I'm actually okay with the controversy, and I'm okay with, you know, I don't know, I'm probably going to be interviewed by someone who, well, I've already been interviewed by one particular person who was rough, definitely a traditionalist. They didn't put the interview out. It was interesting. It was a very interesting interview.
What was the weirdest question that they asked? I'm just curious.
Why I hate teachers.
Oh my God. That's the kind of shit that just like, that like, oh, it's because we watched The Kids We Lose because we had Ross Green on the show, and I had some teachers watch, like, well, it just felt a little anti-teacher. It's like, yeah. No, it's not anti-teacher. It's pro-child and it's pro-learning. Like, those are different things.
Yeah. Well, look, and I'm a pro-teacher,
by the way.
I am a profound advocate for teachers.
Exactly.
I mean, I'm as outraged for teacher, and that's that. So in that conversation, it was clear that it was, you know, clearly he hadn't really read my book, because I make that statement multiple times.
You literally point blank say teachers are victims of the sick. Like, there's a I'm not sure. I actually know the page that you said. You literally said that.
Point blank. And that's just easy. That's the people who don't like what I have to say. They're going to find anything to like throw me under the bus. And so I am definitely, I am a pro teacher. I am an adamant critic of teacher training programs. And I find it devastating that teachers, you know, invest money in getting that training and then devote their lives to a really hard job just to be like, surprise, you have no training that will allow you to be effective. And if you're effective, it's by chance and luck. And you just you somehow got contingency shaping that worked out for you to figure out how to do some stuff. But it's not intentional, and it's not systematic. And so it's a luck of the draw if a teacher actually feels effective or can be effective. And so they are just as much tragic victims of this as kids are.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the universities have really abdicated their responsibility to producing people that are
coming. Oh, the College of Education is, I mean, I'll tell you right now, all of them. Requires immediate reform, if not disbanding, it is colleges of education.
100%. Social sciences, the arts and humanities, arts and science is wrecked.
Yeah.
It's totally fucked up. It's so, like, they just, it's been so ideologically possessed.
Oh, yeah.
That it's no longer rooted in any semblance of reality anymore. Totally. It's completely lost any positioning or attempts to work towards truth or competence or efficacy in terms on the applied side of whatever thing they're doing.
Frustrating. And not only are they not trained in any type of science-based methodology that produces outcomes with kids, but it also instills and reinforces the dogmatism of teaching is talent, right? So like, and it's personal. So which is why, you know, I've attended many IEP meetings in my career, and how, you know, whenever you pose questions about what's occurring for a student and how we could revise things to be more effective, a lot of teachers interpret that as a personal attack. And that is actually built into how they are trained in the College of Education. And I'm not saying that teaching as a profession is not deeply personal. It is deeply personal. Just as being doing behavioral science with kids and families is, because you are in a deeply personal relationship with these families, and you are involved in something that is about changing a kid's life, and parents trust you. It's a deeply personal relationship. So I'm not trying to say that being a teacher isn't deeply personal, but I'm saying that taking it personally when you're asked to evaluate if what you're doing is working, that is very problematic. That you can't object, and that's because they're not trained in science. They're not trained in objective evaluations of data. They're not trained to be a scientist. And so everything they do is seen as part of their bodies. Like, oh, it's my talent. I just do this because this is the way I do things, and it's my talent, it's my flair. And if you criticize it, then you're criticizing me as a human. Rather than I was using this kind of strategy to train phonics, and they're still making a ton of errors on these consonant sounds. We need to make a change to make that better. Like, that's that's not personal. That's like, okay, what we did didn't work. That's the other thing. Like people, you know, we talk about fit learning and yeah, we're super effective, but guess what? That effectiveness comes because we are really sensitive to our failures on a regular basis. Like we are looking at like my frontline people are looking at the learning pictures. They're looking at charts in their sessions and they can see when something is not working. So they're like an immediate, like we are constantly looking at our failures. Like we're failing. This isn't working. It's not about like, oh, we're magicians and it works all the time. It's like, we're really good at like noticing when it's not working and changing that. So teachers, they've got to be empowered in that, you know, that with pragmatism and scientific practices, that power comes from those things. Because that means you have the power to be effective and the power to make a change when you're clearly not being effective, rather than it being about a personal assault on you or coming up with mythical reasons why your kid's failing based on something wrong with them. You know, there's just no effective action. So the fact that it's so personal and I've said this to people and they're like, well, it is personal. And I'm like, well, you're right. Actually it is. It is personal when you're in a deeply personal relationship with another person as part of your profession. Yes, it is personal, but evaluating the impact of your practices shouldn't be.
100%.
You know,
that's marvelous.
Right? Yeah,
right? We should I feel like we've taken up a ton of your time.
God, I haven't paid attention, it's gone by so fast.
And I don't wanna put you over. Is there anything that we missed or that you were hoping to cover? Because honestly, I feel like everyone should read this book, not just if you're in education, if you're a behavior analyst, and it should be a hard look in the mirror because these types of mistakes are not limited to education. Ideological entrenchment is what I want to call it because it is.
Well, and what I just said about teachers is I will tell you, it's something I've experienced with people in our field. So I implore behavior analysts listening to this, who have a gut reaction to be pissed at me right now or feel offended, to take a look at that experience. Because look, you know, I'm not attacking behavior analysts as human beings. I mean, just like teachers, people don't go into behavior analysis to become rich and famous. People go into behavior analysis because they care about making a difference. That's the only explanation, or no one would do this. I mean, give me a break, right? It's not like a fame and fortune based field, and neither is teaching. And so this isn't personal. Like when I'm sitting here questioning the measurement practices that are used in our applied branch, that's not a personal assault on behavior analysts. And when I'm sitting here questioning the certification practices or the training that behavior analysts are receiving, that is not a personal assault on you as a human being. That is me questioning the effectiveness and integrity of training programs. And that's me questioning the effectiveness of practices being used. Because why? Because I care about our field being successful. And I care about every single human being impacted by that field having, like, making the most, you know, robust outcomes they can. And so, you know, we have to step away from this being personal, because it's become personal in our field too. Like if you criticize percent correct or you criticize stretch to fill graphs, and suddenly it's a personal attack on you. No, it's not. I am questioning the integrity of your methods, because that is what we all should be doing. We should all be questioning the integrity of our methods every second we're working with a person. We should be questioning our effectiveness, because that's our responsibility as scientists. Our responsibility of scientists isn't just walk around showing off about how right we are and look for validation. Our role as scientists is to look for errors. Like, where are we messing up? Where have we made mistakes? Where have we not answered a question? Where am I not being effective? That's our responsibility, and it's not personal. Your work is personal. That it absolutely is. But evaluating the effectiveness of it shouldn't be. And when it becomes that, that's when no progress or effective action is possible, because it becomes a personal thing, which it shouldn't be.
Marvelous. Thank you so much. That was great.
Crushed it. Hey friend, before you go, please just do us one small thing. Tell a friend, tag somebody, share this with another colleague in behavior analysis. That is the best way you can help us grow. Remember, you can call in on the Anchor app, anchor.fm/thecontroversialexchange. We can actually hear you, reply to that, include them in future episodes. So that is the easiest way to get your voice heard. If you'd like it to be anonymous, just state so when you submit it, and we can make sure that it is completely anonymous as well. Now, another way that you can really help this podcast grow is leaving us a review in iTunes, specifically on the podcasting app for Apple, and it just helps us reach more people. So whether you enjoyed it or not, please leave us a review. That feedback is helpful. Now, you can find us on social media by searching for The Controversial Exchange. Typically, our handle is Controversial Exchange. However, on Twitter, it is Controversial EX, just because we had to shorten that down a little bit. Now, lastly, there are YouTube videos for every single episode now. We are putting them out there. So please make sure you go check that out, especially if you want to see the visual of like what it is and how we're talking about these sort of things. That will be your place. And one last comment, and that is a quick disclaimer. Now, the views expressed during the Controversial Exchange podcast series are solely those of the individuals involved and do not reflect the official policy or position of any other agency, organization, employer, or company. Assumptions made in the analysis are not reflective of the position of any other entity other than the authors, and since we are critically thinking human beings, these views are always subject to revision, change, and rethinking at any time. Please do not hold us to them in perpetuity. This podcast is to educate and inform, provide discussion, and does not constitute professional advice.